Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, August 11th, 2014. President Obama on vacation in Martha's Vineyard, enjoying extra rounds of golf with his buddies. He better watch his back, because in Baghdad and here in the United States, the backstabbers are coming out of the woodwork.
What they do, they smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Backstabbers, they smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Backstabber number one is Nouri al-Maliki, the puppet who doesn't respond when Obama pulls the strings. And for months now, Obama has been dangling renewed American support for the embattled Baghdad government in exchange for the retirement of our boy, Nouri al-Maliki. Now, putting aside the messy nature of trying to squeeze out a guy who was our pick and who we forced on the Iraqis in two previous elections, well, the Obama administration seems to be getting its way, but Maliki is not cooperating. So, through the machinations of the almost democratic process in Iraq, we have now a nomination for Haider al-Abadi, a member of Maliki's Shiite Islamist Dawah Party, and this was put forward by the nominal leader of the parliament, the president of the nation of Iraq. And he suggested, he actually said that he is going to promote Abadi for the presidency. And so Maliki called a late-night televised news conference. He also ordered security forces, including special units forces, to lock down the Green Zone. That, of course, is the compound that the U.S. built and has partially turned over to the official government in Baghdad. And so there is a risk here that Maliki, as his nation crumbles, and as the Sunni insurgents continue to grab more territory in the northern portions of Iraq and the western portions bordering Syria, he's doubling down on preserving his own power. And this could get very, very messy. And so this nation, which appears completely paralyzed, unable to build any consensus or an ethnic power-sharing arrangement in the central government. And, of course, last week the president of the United States felt compelled to act. And I have my own problems with Obama's decision. I take him at his word that his intention at this point is that we will not be inserting ground troops into this open-ended conflict in Iraq. But by committing U.S. air power, by rearming the Kurds, the United States is taking sides. This will make us a target. And we can end up with a Gulf of Tonkin incident, a plane that gets shot down, or an American who gets taken hostage, kidnapped, and brutally murdered by these bloodthirsty Islamic State fighters. It's very hard to imagine that we will be able to just lob missiles and bombs from the air and send drones for recon and additional peppering, and that this will force the Islamic fighters to turn tail. And so there is the potential here for a military coup in Baghdad, as Maliki clings to power over a country that is crumbling under his very feet. John Kerry lecturing Maliki, there should be no use of force, no introduction of troops or militias into this moment of democracy for Iraq. That's kind of rich, Mr. Kerry. A moment of democracy? Well, you can dream on. You can. General Halgird Hikmet, the chief spokesman for the Kurdish fighters in Iraq, said, "We're all worried about a coup d'etat. Maliki has to know that we have two major units of our troops guarding the parliament and the defense ministry. Then we have the militias that have been generally inactive, those that are controlled by the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, a strong ally of Iran's and an opponent of Maliki. And then there's the old Butter Brigade, spelled B-A-D-R, but pronounced butter according to my more skilled Arabic speakers. And the Butter Brigade is technically part of the Iraqi army, but they remain closely tied to a powerful Shiite member of the Iraqi parliament with links to Iran. And so we could wind up with this Sunni versus Kurds battle in the north and western portions of Iraq as bloodletting occurs in the central portion, Baghdad, and the surrounding areas. And so this could spin out of control much more than American political leaders and commentators seem to acknowledge. Then we have the backstabber who was formerly a part of Clinton's national security team, the former Secretary of State and likely 2016 presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton. Now, politically, I can understand she wants to distance herself from this current president. His ratings are down, and for her to win, putting a little daylight between her and Obama makes political sense. But I also think that it's an opportunist act and political treason of sorts. So early in this current crisis, for a former ally of the president to stab him in the back, as the OJ song says. So she gave an interview on Sunday. And in a moment, we will talk about Obama's interview with Tom Friedman that took place on Friday. And he kind of, in a not knowing, I suppose, exactly what Hillary was going to say, he nonetheless responded to the charges that she is making. And I want to read you the quote in context here, this interview with The Atlantic magazine, because some sources have lifted the word failure out of it and kind of expanded the meaning by taking it out of context. Quote, the failure to help build up a credible fighting force of the people who were the originators of the protests against Assad, this is in Syria, there were Islamists, there were secularists, there was everything in the middle. The failure to do that left a big vacuum, which the jihadists have now filled, said Clinton. Asked about Obama's slogan of don't do stupid stuff to describe his foreign policy, Clinton said, great nations need organizing principles, and don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle. Now, that's a pretty cheap shot, frankly, where she's kind of acting like a cerebral academic in the face of Obama's street language there. And as if this wasn't a big enough wedge to drive between herself and the sitting president of her own party, she also offered strong support for Israel and its Prime Minister Netanyahu. And listen to these comments, because she is cozying up to Israel at the expense of the man who made her Secretary of State. Quote, I think Israel did what it had to respond to the Hamas rockets. Israel has a right to defend itself. The steps Hamas has taken to embed rockets in command and control facilities and tunnel entrances in civilian areas, this makes a response by Israel difficult. Then she rationalizes the so-called collateral damage, civilians, including many children who've been killed. She said, well, mistakes are made. That's one of those maddening Washington comments where no fingers are pointed, no one's held accountable, just mistakes are made. People breathe. The sun comes up. Mistakes are made. Quote, Clinton, we've made them. I don't know a nation, no matter what its values are, and I think the democratic nations have demonstrably better values in a conflict position that hasn't made errors. But ultimately, the responsibility rests with Hamas. Now, these are AIPAC talking points. And here, she is invoking her husband's foreign policy mantra, that Americans would rather be wrong and strong. And she's clearly morally wrong. in explaining away Israel's targeting of civilian locations, and each day new incidents surface of inexplicable immoral behavior by Israeli troops in their recent so-called incursion into Gaza. And she's defending all that. No caveats. Well, you know, there were a few of those incidents when they blew up the four boys on the beach. I was a little squeamish. Nope. Hillary is a hawk. She is an opportunist. And it speaks volumes that her biggest ally in foreign policy is former Republican Secretary of Defense Bob Gates. Now to the situation with the Kurds. The U.S. announced today that we are directly sending armaments to the fighters on the Kurdish side in north and western Iraq. But instead of having the Baghdad government send them weapons or have the Pentagon send them weapons, we are informed that the Central Intelligence Agency is better positioned to supply the Kurdish Peshmerga with Russian-made guns like AK-47s that the U.S. military doesn't use. Now, scratch your head and ask yourself, where is the CIA's stockpile of AK-47s? Well, I can't tell you exactly where it is today, but at one point, many sources indicated to me that Benghazi and that CIA safe house, not the it wasn't an embassy, the consulate, but the second location in Benghazi was reportedly the place where they stockpiled Libyan weapons to be run into Syria. To, as Hillary suggests, to try to arm the vetted moderate elements in the Syrian civil war. And Obama's going to shoot that down without even needing a drone. And I'll get to that in a moment. But arming the Kurds has been the subject of weeks of internal deliberation and official silence by Obama's foreign policy advisors. And it is complex. The implications of this could be very serious down the road. And last week, at the end of the week, I released an interview with Professor Muhammad Ayoub of Michigan State University. And he corrected one of my perceptions. I explained that I thought that by arming the Kurds, we run the risk of alienating the government of Turkey because of its long-term effort to suppress the Kurds. And Ayoub says that in the last couple of years that the Erdogan government in Turkey has softened its position on the Kurds because they form an important buffer on the southern Turkish border with Iraq. So that's a little different perception than I have been holding. But we also learned over the weekend that the Kurdish fighters ran out of ammunition, and that's why they had to end their conflict, at least temporarily, with the Islamic State fighters. And this is one of the critiques that I would have of the president without going a full Hillary. And that is, if we follow his logic, why did he wait until 40,000 people had trapped themselves on Mount Sinjar? Was he really waiting for the Baghdad government to respond in some meaningful way by power sharing or even by helping those who are fleeing the repression? And so that could be, I think, a valid question in criticizing the president's decision and decision-making process. But we learned today that we delivered 3 plane loads of ammo to the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters. Now to the president's Friday interview with Tom Friedman of the New York Times. I don't know why the Times buried it in the Saturday edition, but the president had a lot to say, and I give Friedman credit for a good interview and teasing out some important points. And in particular, as I say, the timing of this is a little hard to gauge, but the interview with Friedman was on Friday. The Atlantic published its interview with Clinton on Sunday, but I don't know exactly which one took place first. And maybe through the NSA and other intelligence assets, Obama got an advance on the Atlantic interview with his former Secretary of State. So Friedman poses the question, wouldn't things be better had we armed the secular Syrian rebels early or kept U.S. troops in Iraq? And Obama said, in particular with respect to Syria, the notion that arming the rebels would have made a difference has always been a fantasy. That's a quote. This idea that we could provide some light arms or even more sophisticated arms to what was essentially an opposition made up of former doctors, farmers, pharmacists, and so forth, and that they were going to be able to battle not only a well-armed state, but also a well-armed state backed by Russia, backed by Iran, a battle-hardened Hezbollah, that was never in the cards. The idea of arming a certain safe group of people in Syria, he said there's not as much capacity as you would hope. Now, what's interesting is, and I agree with the president there, I have always supported his restraint. And when he appeared to be losing that resolve over the alleged chemical weapons incident in August of last year, I was sharply critical of the president. And it was Vladimir Putin who saved him from himself and that phony red line or bright line or whatever line it was that he drew. But curiously, Obama does use the same terminology as Clinton regarding the Sunni fighters. He said, they're filling a vacuum. And the question for us has to be not simply how we counteract them militarily, but how are we going to speak to a Sunni majority in that area that right now is detached from the global economy? And the other real takeaway from this Tom Friedman interview is that Obama shows a little bit of honesty and daylight on what I consider to be one of his biggest blunders, and I'm sorry there's a list of them, and that was the support for the takedown of Gaddafi in Libya. And in two parts of the interview, Friedman quotes him, this from the end, I'll give you an example of a lesson I had to learn that still has ramifications to this day, and that's our participation in the coalition that overthrew Gaddafi in Libya. Continuing to quote the president, I absolutely believe that it was the right thing to do. Had we not intervened, it's likely that Libya would be Syria right now, and there would have been much more death, more disruption, more destruction. But what is also true is that I think we and our European partners underestimated the need to come in full force if you're going to do this. So that's a lesson I now apply every time I ask the question, should we intervene militarily? Do we have an answer for the day after? Well, I was just dinging Hillary Clinton for her support from Robert Gates. And as I've mentioned frequently, the only time I really agreed with Gates is when he said, we have no business going into Libya and taking out Gaddafi. That was one of the things that Hillary strongly supported. And even as she gets beat up by the distractions of Benghazi, she's never been honest about the blunder it was to take out Gaddafi under the guise of a no-fly zone and protecting 10,000 people from genocide in Benghazi. And it's because of the similarities between the call to arms for Libya that are being used in this call to arms for Syria and Iraq that gives me considerable pause. I also paused when I saw Michael Gordon's name attached to this analysis piece in the New York Times about the president's decisions. Michael Gordon, of course, collaborated with Judith Miller in the articles that falsely reported about the threat of mobile weapons labs and the curveball bullshit that were used to lead us by the nose into Iraq. Nevertheless, Gordon's been covering this region and these issues for a long time. And he notes that while Obama has said that there is no American military solution to Iraq's problems, he correctly notes that there's no prospect of drawing the Sunni extremists into Iraq's political process. And I do think this idea that we're going to have a power-sharing government in Baghdad that will pacify the country, help extract the Sunnis from control in the north, and resist the partitioning that is desired by the Kurds, I think that ship has already sailed. One of the lingering questions for me is about the Yazidis. They're described as an ancient religious sect linked to Zoroastrianism. I think you know what I mean. And my question has been, why did they flee to Mount Sinjar? Now, I know it's a holy site for them, but it's a barren mountain. People say there's no water, nothing to eat, nowhere to sit. There isn't even a shadow. There's no shade. Why did 40,000 or more people like lemmings flee the oppressive Sunnis and put themselves into a situation where they could be surrounded and held hostage without any resources? I guess there is a religious explanation. And if you happen to know or you've seen an article or report that sheds some light on this, I'd appreciate it if you'd pass it along to me. I am curious to get the answer, and I'll share it with our listeners. You know my email. It's peter@peterbcollins.com. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here. People like James Hallwell, who voluntarily gives us $10 a month. Michael Sevilla, Grant Gibson, who frequently posts interesting items over on Facebook. Thank you, Grant. And Terry Paris, the one who upgraded to a $10 monthly subscription recently. Thank you very much for that, Terry. So I appreciate the support that people give me. I'll let you know that for whatever reason, I haven't had any new subscribers at any level in the last week or two. And I'd appreciate it if you could change that. I need your help and your support. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, click the sign-up link. You get options, $5, $10, $20 a month. The best deals are $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the continental U.S. get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag. Well, I'm happy to report that there is a new ceasefire. Last week, we had a 72-hour ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. And when it expired, the fighting renewed, but on more of a chessboard approach. Then late Sunday, it was announced that Egypt had persuaded the Israelis to accept a new offer of ceasefire that went into effect, I believe, at midnight local time, Monday morning. And we're told that Israeli negotiators have returned to Cairo and that the talks continue. Now, the big problem here is that Israel has made it pretty clear that it simply wants to eviscerate Hamas. It wants Hamas to go away. And while Israeli officials are participating in the talks, the Palestinians have made it clear that in the talks last week that Israel would agree to nothing. And then when Hamas fires a few of these meaningless rockets, Israel says, well, we won't talk until the entire class sits down and is quiet. And this is a common tactic on the part of Israel, where they go through the motions, but they won't agree to anything substantial. So we have 500,000 people in Gaza who are homeless, 200,000 living in UN schools, the water supply, sanitation systems, the power station was blown up so that Gazans are now more dependent than ever on Israel for electricity. 10 out of 26 hospitals have been shut down. So the damage is severe, and the death count is more than 1,900 Palestinians, 3 Israeli civilians, and 64 Israeli soldiers have been killed. Back to these shores. Over the weekend, Mark Fuller ran into some trouble with the law. Scratch your head, who's Mark Fuller? Well, he's a federal judge in Alabama. He's the one who presided over the railroading of former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman, who still remains in federal prison in Louisiana. And Mark Fuller is a walking set of contradictions and conflicts of interest. While he sat on the bench, he owned almost 50% of a company that had a sweetheart no-bid contract worth hundreds of millions of dollars with the Department of Defense. And Roger Shuler, our friend, the blogger who was devastated by his imprisonment for 5 months behind bogus charges of defaming or libeling public figures in Alabama. He previously reported on Mark Fuller's divorce proceedings, which suggested drug use, infidelity, and other problems in the home. Now, over the weekend, Fuller was arrested and charged with misdemeanor battery in what appears to be a domestic violence report that came from his wife. And it's not clear if this is a new wife or the original wife, and they actually didn't go through with the divorce proceedings. I'm not privy to the intimate details of the judge's life. But police responded to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel at nearly 11 p.m. Saturday night. This is in Atlanta. Officers spoke to Fuller's wife, who stated she was assaulted by her husband. She was not named by the police, but she was treated by paramedics and refused treatment at a hospital. And by the way, I know a lot of listeners care about Roger Shuler, my friend and colleague, who, as I said, spent 5 months imprisoned on a phony contempt charge related to claims of defamation for publishing articles about public figures like Mark Fuller. I heard from Roger just this morning, and while life is not great, they lost their home. He and Carol are alive and they're safe. And Roger said he doesn't have too much time to devote to the blog, as he is trying desperately to find work to support him and his wife. Lee Fung is a very talented young investigative reporter. His website is called republicreport.org. He also freelances, and I found this story at Vice News. And it is alarming. What he reveals is that leading civil rights groups have sold us out on net neutrality. Last Friday, before the Federal Communications Commission closed its comment period on network neutrality, a massive coalition of Asian, Latino, and Black civil rights groups filed letters arguing that regulators should lay off internet service providers and accept FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler's idea. In other words, what Fung writes here is something close to half of the entire civil rights establishment just sold out the internet. The civil rights group's letters argue that reclassification of broadband services as a public utility, which is the only path forward for real net neutrality after a federal court ruling last January, would somehow, quote, harm communities of color. The groups wrote to the FCC to tell them that we do not believe that the door to Title II should be opened. Simply put, Fung writes, these groups, many of which claim to carry the mantle of Martin Luther King Jr., are saying that Comcast and Verizon should be able to create internet slow lanes and fast lanes, and such a change would magically improve the lives of non-white Americans. He continues, the filings reveal a who's who of civil rights groups willing to shill on behalf of the telecom industry. One filing lists prominent civil rights groups, NAACP, League of United Latin American Citizens, Urban League, National Black Council on Black Civil Participation, and Al Sharpton's National Action Network. The other features Council of Korean Americans, Japanese American Citizens League, National Black Farmers Association, Rainbow Push Coalition, that's Jesse Jackson's group, OCA, Asian Pacific American Advocates, the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce, the Latino Coalition, and many more. And the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council coordinated many of the participants in the anti-net neutrality filings. Last year, the Center for Public Integrity published an investigation of MMTC showing that the group has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars from, you guessed it, Verizon, Comcast, National Cable and Telecommunications Association. That's the group Tom Wheeler, the FCC chair, once worked for. He ran it. the group that attacked the Obama administration's first attempt at net neutrality while celebrating the proposed and successful merger between Comcast and NBC. And Fung continues, the telecom cash has become a vital source of funding for cash-starved nonprofits. OCA, the Asian American Civil Rights Nonprofit, formerly known as the Organization of Chinese Americans, counts Comcast as a major donor and sponsor of its events and galas. So it's really ugly to see corporations use these groups that have all done great work advocating for people of color in this country, that those groups can be bought and sold. And I've seen it over the years, Jesse Jackson and Operation Push, time after time, there's a controversy. Jesse Jackson enters the case. He finds a way to broker peace over racially charged issues, and then walks away with a piece of the action. It's a really ugly model, and it's based on what Jesse learned from Mayor Daley in the Chicago political machine. And I'm really sorry to see it play out on an even bigger scale here. And finally today, as you may know, the New York Times ran a series of 6 or 7 powerful editorials calling on the Obama administration and the federal government to legalize marijuana at the federal level. And yesterday, the New York Times ran a very interesting story about the latest casualty in the war on some drugs. She is Dr. Sue Sisley, a psychiatrist at the University of Arizona who sought federal approval to study marijuana's effectiveness in treating military veterans with PTSD. She was fired by the University of Arizona, and we'll get to the details of that in a moment. But the article explains that the federal government categorizes marijuana as Schedule 1 with ecstasy, heroin, LSD. And as a result, the non-psychoactive uses, the non-smoking uses of marijuana, those that don't involve THC, those that relate to the other properties in cannabis, particularly those called cannabinoids, that have shown great promise, and there are actually some studies underway in this country, many in other parts of the world, that show that cannabinoids, which do not get you high, nonetheless can have incredible impacts on the human body, including fighting cancer cells. And the hysteria that surrounds this has cost Dr. Sisley her job. So she went to the state legislature trying to get funding for research. Her study is supposed to use 5 different strains of marijuana that would be smoked or vaporized by 70 vets. The goal is to develop a marijuana drug in plant form that would be smoked or vaporized. Now, in March, the Arizona House passed a Republican-sponsored bill designed to provide her project with some funding from fees collected in the state's medical marijuana program. But the bill was killed by a state senator named Kimberly Yee, a Republican who refused to put the legislation on the agenda. So angry about her opposition, a group of veterans began a recall effort against Ms. Yee. Some of those are veterans who'd been treated by Dr. Sisley. And so Senate leaders concluded that she herself was involved in the campaign, which she flatly denies. But the president of the state Senate called the university's chief lobbyist to complain that Dr. Sisley seemed to be lobbying too aggressively and inappropriately. The lobbyist said he would call back, and he told the state Senate president this will not be a problem going forward. And then she was fired. They claimed it was for budget reasons. But the pattern there of behavior is very clear. We've got a lot of work to do to get people to think about science instead of emotion, to really acknowledge the failure of prohibition of marijuana, and that our outdated, ill-informed laws prevent people from using marijuana for palliative reasons, you know, and benefits when smoked, and for the research that I cited related to cannabinoids. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You are fully authorized to share this podcast without absolutely anyone on the planet. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.